Welcome to the Leadership Loop podcast. This is a space for you to learn, try, get feedback, and grow. We want you to get a little bit better each time you show up here because you learn something and then you try it. So today we are asking an incredibly important question. What can we learn, good and bad, from the history of Christian leadership? To do that, we have with us Dr. Jerry Sitzer. Dr. Sitzer, you are the author of 9 books. You're professor emeritus at Whitworth University. You are the senior fellow of the Office of Church Engagement with Whitworth. And personally, to me, you are a mentor, an advisor, and a friend. I've known you for many years. You were actually my academic advisor at Whitworth and my professor and teacher. So your impact on me runs incredibly deep, and I thank you for that. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for being here. So today, we want to ask you this question because you are a church historian. You're deeply respected for your work in church history. And we want to ask this question, what can we learn from the history of Christian leadership? We've got leaders listening from all sectors of work and business and the church. And so as you think about the history of Christianity, is there a period of time that would be relevant for us to learn from right now?
Well, I did ponder that a little bit because 2,000 years of history is a lot of resource to draw from. And I decided to land on 1 century, the 4th century, and there are some specific reasons why.
Do tell.
You've got to get into their world and out of ours. So for the first roughly 300 years of the history of Christianity, the Christian movement grew very slowly and steadily under inhospitable circumstances. Rome did not like Christians. They were suspicious at best and oppositional at worst. And they often persecuted Christians, not always, but often. And so the leadership of the church had to figure out how to grow the church under those circumstances. Mm. Imagine doing church with no buildings, with none of the visible kind of features that we find in the United States and Western Europe today. Mm. But the 4th century is different. The first Christian emperor, Constantine, assumed the throne in the year 307 and died in the year 337. Christianity became at first legally recognized as a religion and then increasingly privileged in the culture. Mm-hmm. So in a matter of one generation, you move from a fairly marginal presence in the empire, influential but marginal, to being the dominant religion in the world. Mm-hmm. Constantine started building church buildings, and they were huge buildings. It became popular to be Christian. People would attend church not just to worship God, but to cut a deal in business, to meet somebody who was more politically and economically powerful than they were, to meet a nice girl, mm-hmm. whatever you needed to do. So people began to climb in society by doing religion, by doing Christianity.
That's so interesting.
The numbers are staggering. In the year 300, just before the last great persecution against Christianity, maybe there were 5 million Christians in the Roman Empire of about 60 million. Scholars say by the year 360, there were 30 million Christians. So imagine a growth rate that extreme on a relatively short period of time. So think about it becomes materially present, big church buildings, festivals, feasts, this sort of thing. Powerful people are now attending the church, including the emperor himself and his family. Big church buildings, popularity, but there were signs of decline going on at the same time. One was political compromise. Mm. I mean, religion and politics began to be intermingled, for example. There were a lot of people who became catechumens, kind of disciples in training, but they would never move all the way through the process to the end point where they'd be baptized and receive their first communion and so on. So we had a lot of fellow travelers who would show up at worship, but not be involved, not get engaged, never become serious disciples. Now, you get the idea. Yep. Popular, powerful, privileged, growth in numbers, decline in meaningful membership and commitment. Hmm. Okay. Now, you're a leader of churches like this.
Yeah. So would you say that it became more prevalent that there were Christian leaders and Christian disciples who were half-hearted in their faith and were utilizing religion for their own personal gain.
Well, we have some pretty good evidence that there were a lot of bishops. That was the main office. Bishops weren't just administrators. They were preachers and they were pastors, but they had large staffs and a lot of responsibility. There were a number of them who kind of kissed up to the emperor. In fact, the emperor or the emperors would build lavish residences for them. Mm. They would dress differently as if they were kind of the religious counterpart to Roman senators. Mm. There were climbers in that group, people who would be willing to compromise in order to maintain their privileged position with the emperor. This should all be sounding quite familiar, by the way, to you. So, there was a lot of risk involved, and there were bishops who really made bad decisions morally and politically and theologically in lots of ways in order to maintain a certain kind of power. But we do have some great examples of leaders in the fourth century church that were just outstanding Christians and leaders. And considering their circumstances, that's the group I think we have the most to learn from.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you said, there are parallels today between the fourth century and now of Christians who are in positions of leadership, whether it's in the church or not, whether it's political or business, who are maybe sacrificing their Christian convictions on the altar of power.
Correct.
On the altar of money and success. And so before we get to the good examples, what do we have to learn from the bad examples? What did they sacrifice that we shouldn't be sacrificing?
Well, there are a couple of things. You have to maintain a sense of personal discipline, and you have to decide that keeping a critical distance from cultural elites and people of power is just a good discipline for all of us to practice. As we work our way into the system can work its way into us. So there has to be some degree of distance, critical distance, from the powers that be. That doesn't mean complete disengagement, but we easily become intoxicated when we start to spend time with wealthy, powerful people. It's not wrong that we do that, and we've got lots of examples in history of people who did it and did it well, but we have too many cautionary tales at the same time of people who were profoundly affected by the very people they hoped to influence and change. In other words, when you get invited to the White House gets inside you. Now, that doesn't mean it's wrong to go to the White House, but there should be a real question mark in the back of your head saying, if I go there, what is it going to do to me and how will it affect my faith?
Yeah.
Same would be true if you go on Oprah, or you're on TV, or you gain some kind of prominent attention in the culture for one reason or another. It's really important to figure out how to distance yourself and maintain integrity to the faith over the long haul.
That I love that. I think that's so important because, you know, whether you're with a person of power, you're in a political position, or you get promoted at work. There are any sort of bump up, any sort of when you are in the atmosphere of someone who is higher than you or more privileged than you, you always have to ask that question, what is this going to do to my faith? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we just don't ask. Mm-hmm. Most people aren't aware that they'll be affected in that way. And so looking back at Christian history and seeing how it did affect so many people and the parallels between how it affects so many people now, I think that's a great cautionary advice to go make sure you know how people and power are affecting your faith.
I mean, and there are great examples again. William Wilberforce, who had an evangelical conversion and was a member of parliament for 45 years single-handedly with actually a group of Christian supporters called the Clapham Sect. They met once or twice a week for decades in prayer and study and strategy. Mm. This was the group that led to the abolition of slavery in England. Mm-hmm. And the final vote in the House of Parliament happened 3 days before Wilberforce died in 1833. Now, this is a man who was ridiculously rich and well-connected, but maintained integrity over the long haul. Wow. Well, we've got some examples of the fourth century of people who did the same thing.
Yeah. Can you share one with us?
Yeah. Let me give you some names. There were, by the fourth century, you have to think west and east. So the western half of the empire, Latin-speaking, capital city in Rome. Eastern half of the empire, Greek-speaking, capital city in Constantinople. It was one empire, but it was sort of gradually drifting apart. In the West, we have leaders like Augustine of Hippo, died in 430, Ambrose of Milan, who, by the way, baptized Augustine. He died in 397. I'm more intrigued by some of the leaders of the East. There was a larger population there, and the most influential emperors were in the East. So that would be especially the Cappadocian Fathers, as they're called, two brothers and a best friend. Gregory of Nyssa, Gregory of Nazianzus, and Basil of Caesarea. Fancy names. Don't worry about that.
You sound so smart when you say
those. I know.
Those.
Well, I'm not. And John Chrysostom is another one. He was actually the Archbishop of Constantinople for a number of years. These are unusual people, and I like their examples as examples of Christian leadership in our kind of cultural situation.
Yeah. Why do you like those people specifically?
All right, let me mention a few things that I think are useful for leaders. The first thing is that all of them spent time apart. Now, back then, monasticism was kind of a popular movement. Mm-hmm. And in this case, all of them spent time in isolation. John Chrysostom actually lived in a cave by himself for 2 years, extreme, needless to say.
Yes.
And in a monastic community for 4 years. Augustine, after his conversion, moved back to North Africa, then part of the Roman world, with a group of his best friends and started a monastic community. Basil of Caesarea lived at the monastery started by his sister, Macrina, the younger.
That.
Yeah. And so did Nyssa, his younger brother, and Gregory of Nazianzus. So the first thing is that they were able to distance themselves from kind of the larger, powerful culture without rejecting it. That protected them from over-accommodation because all of them were drafted into service. But by the time they landed in service, they developed a capacity to be able to say no, to see what was happening because they had stood outside it for a time, you see.
And so that it's almost as if that like that isolation gave them some interior depth.
Oh, nice phrase. I'm going to remember that, really. Isolation can lead to interior depth. That's really a good way of looking at it. They also had time to study the Bible. John Chrysostom had virtually the entire New Testament memorized. And one way you observe this is by reading his sermons. We've got maybe, I don't know, 400 of his sermons still in print. I mean, I've read some of them with you guys in our reading group. And they're amazing. First, he didn't use any notes. He preached extemporaneously. But he just pours through Scripture. It's there. He'll mention one thing, and that will bounce to another text, and then another text, until he's kind of spun a web of texts. My point is that isolation protected them from entering positions of influence and leadership at a young age where you're more vulnerable. They had a little more distance. They developed virtues. They practiced disciplines. They learned Scripture. And they were more prepared for the engagement with the larger culture through that experience of some isolation. So that would be one thing I think is valuable
for
us.
Can I make a note on that? Because I think so often right now in culture, we talk about skill development or what are your gifts and how do you increase your gifts, your natural talents or your God-given gifts even. And what you're saying is these guys were all gifted. But
they had,
because of this time of isolation, they developed character that sustained them wherever their gifts would take them.
Correct.
And I think that's so important for us to hear is that as a leader, if you have a gift of leadership or a gift of teaching or whatever it is, if you don't have the character to hold you up where your gift will take you, then you're going to fall flat.
You're going to
really
be
quick.
In trouble. So I would say isolation was the first one, some form of isolation. The second principle then would be they developed a deep root system in virtue, like humility and wisdom and so on. Another part of that root system was a deep love for and understanding of the person of Jesus Christ.
Yes.
These guys were so saturated in Jesus, but it wasn't the popular culture Jesus. It was the Jesus of the New Testament, the rabbi from Nazareth, Jesus that is rooted in their understanding of the New Testament. Mm. And you can tell it in their writings. I'm going to read a quote.
Yeah, please do.
From Nazianzus, who wrote, he's a very famous theologian. But when you read this or when you listen to this quote, you realize you're stepping into a world where they had such a profound love, fresh love, for the wonder of the incarnation and what God coming into human flesh did for us and our sake and our salvation.
Yeah.
So he's describing Jesus here. He hungered, yet he fed thousands. He thirsted, yet he explained, "Whoever thirsts, let him come to me and drink." He was tired, yet he is the rest of the weary and the burdened. He prays, yet he hears prayer. He weeps, yet he puts an end to all weeping. He is sold, and cheap was the price, 30 pieces of silver. Yet he buys back the world at the mighty cost of his own blood. He is led to the slaughter, yet he shepherds Israel and now the whole world as well. A lamb, he is dumb, yet he is the word of God. He is weak and wounded, yet he cures every disease and every weakness. He is brought up to the tree and nailed to it, yet by the tree of life he restores us. He is given vinegar to drink, gall to eat. And who is he? Why, one who turned water into wine, who took away the taste of bitterness, who is all sweetness and desire. He surrenders his life, yet he has power to take it again. He dies, but he vivifies, and by death destroys death. He is buried, yet he rises again. Now, I don't even know what to say about that. This man was brilliant, and yet that is so beautifully simple, as he describes the tension of the divine and human natures in the person of Jesus Christ. So, deep root system.
Yeah.
Here's a third one. They were educated. Education was not an enemy to them, but they always passed it through a Christian filter.
That's great.
So all the, Nazianzus and Basil of Caesarea ended up studying in Athens. Augustine, studied in Rome. They went to the best schools. They studied under the best teachers. Most of their teachers were pagan philosophers and rhetoricians. They took all of that massive learning from the classical world and they passed it through a Christian filter. So you don't see them reacting against it. Oh, that's all bad and worldly, or completely embracing it. They filter it.
Wow.
And they subject it to a Christian worldview.
And it's because they're deeply rooted that they can do that. It's because they have this, like you said, it's a fresh love for the real Jesus.
Right.
That they're able to take this learning and go, I know how to filter this.
I know how to filter this. Yeah. And how to make it useful to the church. That's why we still read them today.
And then their Christian faith, their faith in Jesus, isn't an accessory to their life. It's the foundation of their life.
It's central to everything they are and everything they do.
Yeah.
All right, three other brief points about them that I think are useful. They had a holistic view of discipleship. All right, so what we do as a church today is we jump on some kind of cause. If you're progressive, it's going to be this. If you're more conservative, it'll be this. It'll be pro-life. It'll be pro-choice. It'll be this and that. And they had those issues back then, too. But they always drew it into a more holistic understanding of life. So they would be a very conservative in their sexual ethic, okay? And at the same time, spend much more attention on economic justice. Well, we recoil from that in our age. We would never touch that. But they preached many, many sermons about a wealth, about social justice and economics. And some of their sermons, I've read them in this area, well, they'd lose their jobs in our culture because they went after greed, abuse of wealth, abuse of power, creating a social system that would always keep the poor poor and the rich rich. Now, that was as important to them as a more conservative sexual ethic. Mm-hmm. It was both and, not either or. Yeah. They had a holistic view of what it meant to be a disciple of Jesus that touched all areas of life, not just those areas that we are willing to have touched. Yeah.
So this, I mean, that speaks so well to today. Did they have division like we do? And how did they deal with it?
Oh my gosh. Yes, they did. I mean, on all kinds of levels. So the hippodrome horse races and chariot races were really popular in Constantinople. And Chrysostom, the great preacher, his nickname was Golden Mouth, by the way, because he was such a great preacher. He would often complain in the pulpit, you come to church as pious Christians in the morning and the afternoon, you go to stadiums and you bet on your favorite horses or your favorite teams and then get into fist fights with each other. So there were controversies when it came to athletic teams. Yeah. There were controversies theologically. The Arian controversy, for example, divided the church deeply. They were in the middle of all of that, but they tried to maintain a steady course. Mm-hmm. They were in it for the long haul.
Ooh, say that again.
They were in it for the long haul. They just weren't. They weren't up for quick fixes. They didn't take shortcuts. They didn't think one Supreme Court decision, our problem is solved. Mm-hmm. They understood that disciple making is a long-term commitment and process. Mm-hmm. And they had long careers, and they worked hard, and they remained steady in spite of the vicissitudes of culture and even the vicissitudes within the church.
You said something when we were meeting a couple weeks ago with a pastor's group. You said, power at the expense of the gospel is not power you want.
Correct.
And I think that's exactly what you're talking about, is if you're gaining power through sacrificing the gospel, sacrificing your faith,
and your integrity. Sure. Yeah, in fact, a number of these guys spent time in exile. Athanasius, the great and often pretty irascible and contentious bishop of Alexandria, he was bishop there for 45 years, died in 373.
And he was,
he spent 17 years in exile by the emperor because he was a troublemaker.
But he was also a young leader, wasn't he?
He started to be a bishop when he was 28 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. So yes, he held an important position at a young age, and he remained there for 45 years.
Wow.
17, he was driven out of the city and out of the church by an emperor or a party, a group of people who were his enemies, and then he would come right back and get right back to business again. So did they face opposition? They did indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last thing I want to say is that they cultivated friendships. They didn't do this alone. Mm. Probably the best example there were the three we call the Cappadocian fathers, two brothers and a best friend. And we actually have the huge benefit and privilege of reading their letters to each other. Mm. I actually used that in a master's class I taught. The students read the correspondence among these three best friends, and they kept each other on course, and you could tell in their a reading. So they would complain about the weather. The younger brother and best friend always complained about Basil because he was kind of the operator, and he loved to boss them around, you know. And they would complain about opponents and all kinds of things, the postal system. And then they turn right around and talk about key theological ideas, and they'd encourage each other and call each other to hope. That friendship sustained them. We cannot do ministry in isolation, nor can we do ministry if we're always the big man in the room or the big woman in the room.
Yep.
We've got to have peers. We've got to have people who can call us to account and say, Michael, Jerry, no more.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that to each other. And you'll see that pattern. Augustine, when he was in Rome, actually way back in his youth, he had a few best friends. They all were converted. They remained best friends their whole life. Hmm. They did ministry together. Now, he was the most popular and the most famous, but not necessarily the best pastor.
Yeah.
But think about that 45-year friendship.
Wow.
with Alypius. That was his name. Yeah. And the Cappadocian father, same thing. Mm. And another thing I love is that several of the Cappadocian fathers paid tribute to one of their best friends at their memorial service, their funeral. And they would give what's called a funeral oration, and they're beautiful. Hmm. And it reminds you what deep friendship can do.
Yes. I've heard it said that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, you've got to go together.
Oh, nice. And yeah, that's a good phrase. Well, they did the latter there.
Yes.
So long haul of ministry, they stayed true, they stayed steady. They had a deep root system. They built good friendships. They were deeply rooted in the gospel at a deep root system. And they could create some distance from the culture.
So as I think about this, Jerry, I think what a great resource for someone who is a Christian leader, whether it's in the church or the business world, and they're looking at what you're saying. You're saying, look, you've got to find, you've got to have character. You've got to have depth. You've got to have a real relationship with Jesus. You've got to be in it for the long haul, in it to win it. This is all stuff that is, again, founded on your faith in Jesus.
Yes.
And you take all the education of the world, you take all that, but you filter it through that. This is the fabric of your being. Mm-hmm. And as I think about that, it reminds me of your book, Resilient Faith, as a great resource for someone who would want to, you can see it here, as a great resource for someone who'd want to dig deeper into what does it look like to build this sort of faith that allows me to lead well into the future.
Yeah.
And not just far into the future, but well. I want to lead well. I don't want to lead poorly. I want to lead well. And if you're someone who's listening, you want to lead well, this is a great book to figure out how do I have that sort of faith that lasts through the turmoil, that can come up against opposition and still come out strong. And so I've read the book. I love the book, and I highly encourage it to anyone who else.
Thank you, Michael.
Want to grow in their leadership and more importantly, grow in their faith.
And
now
Athanasius, he was fired from his job 5 times and got rehired. Michael, I hope that doesn't happen to you.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you. People.
Anyway, I wish you well. I love Life Center so much, and the people here always have.
Can I ask you one question before we leave?
Sure.
Okay, so if you is thinking especially about leaders who are not leading the church, but they're leading in the business sector, and maybe it's one of these things. But what's one thing that you'd want to say to them right now in the culture that we're in and the things that we're facing? What's a message from Jerry Sitzer to someone who's in the business world, the education world, just outside of the church world and leading?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't change a thing. I mean, leadership applies across all disciplines and in all venues of service. There's nothing particularly unique about being a church leader. They have a different set of responsibilities, to be sure. But the same virtues apply. The same root system is needed. Mm-hmm. The same friendships that hold you accountable. Your openness to learning from a broad range of fields that aren't specifically Christian. It really is the same game, just a different kind of setting. Hmm. And we desperately need people who will not sacrifice means in order to achieve worthy ends.
Yes.
It's one package. Wow. Jesus Christ is both means and end.
Hmm. That's so good. I love that, Jerry. And I love you. I love your passion for Jesus. I love your passion and knowledge for church history. And I think it's so important that we have this conversation with you, but that we keep looking back to history so that we don't make the same mistakes.
Right.
But back to history so we can learn from gems of wisdom from these incredible saints who've gone before us, because we do have so much to learn from them. And that's one of the things that I love about you. You always bring a story. You always bring wisdom from the past that helps me move forward. So I pray that for all the people who've been listening, that you grab a hold of something here and that you take it, you try it, you learn from it, you grow in your faith and you grow in your leadership, because when leaders get better, everyone gets better. Thanks for listening to the Leadership Loop podcast. Jerry, thank you for being here, and we will see you next time.